Here comes another weekly Mayo from your friends at Radio 2. Thank you for downloading the best bits of Drive Time. This week we can offer you a nice chat with Dolly Parton, a country legend, I think so. She's talking about her career and her new stuff. One of the UK's best-loved comedians, Miranda Hart, was in for a chat and talking about her new stuff. There's a lot of stuff around in December. And we were joined in the book club by top Canadian author Denis Thériault. And Nigel brought us some lamb with pumpkin and sultanas, which was fantastic because everybody loves sultanas. The Radio 2 Book Club is back with another top suggestion for you. This one is called The Peculiar Life of a Lonely Postman, and it's written by Denis Thériault, who is with us in the studio. Hello, Denis.
Hello.
How are you, sir?
I'm quite fine.
So you're Denis, and if I say Dennis by mistake, then I apologise.
It won't be the first time.
No, OK. And you are from Canada?
Yes, from Montreal, in fact.
Now, just before we explain any more about the book, Matt, can you describe the cover, please, of The Peculiar Life of a Lonely Postman?
Yes, it's a very simple cover, really. What we've got is it's just a branch of cherry blossom right across the front of the book, and Denis' name right at the top with The Peculiar Life of a Lonely Postman down below.
First time you had to get it right, you said Dennis. It's Denis.
Denis. I corrected myself straight away. It was seamless and no one would have noticed.
Now, Denis,
I'm surprised that you can say Thériault so well.
Denis Thériault.
Yeah, it's a difficult name to pronounce, no, isn't it?
My mother was a French teacher, so I can do the pronunciation. I haven't got a clue what I'm saying, but Denis Thériault I can do.
Okay.
Now, here's the thing, Denis. When we do the book club, we have new books. We have often new authors, but they're always new books. They've just come out. They're about to come out. Your book is completely different. When did this book get published, first of all?
It was published for the first time in 2005 in Montreal. And when it was published, it was mostly ignored. And for a few years, I thought it was just dead. Then suddenly it became to be published in some other countries like Germany, Turkey, etc. And now it is in the UK, which I'm mostly satisfied.
Well, it's just amazing that it's a book that started life in 2005 and, like you said, pretty much died and it disappeared. And now we are in 2014 and it's back out and getting all these extraordinary
reviews. I feel quite lucky about that.
So it's led an extraordinary life, and here we are, and it's now out. Tell us about your postman. Tell us about Bilodeau's at the heart of your story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should say that this story is the story of a sentimental obsession. Bilodeau is a postman. He lives in Montreal with Bill, his goldfish, that he considers his only true friend, in fact, is fond of penmanship, and this is his hobby, and is dedicated to his job. But he has this secret, this hidden vice. Bilodeau is an inquisitive postman who steams open certain personal letters before delivering them. This is how he comes across these mysterious letters, touching letters, each composed of a single haiku from Ségolène, a woman who lives in Guadeloupe and with whom he falls in love madly.
So he falls in love with her purely on the basis of the letters that she's
writing.
He falls
in love with her poetry, with her penmanship, because she has a wonderful calligraphy. And he falls in love with this woman that you don't know. Maybe you don't know her because Bilodeau is the kind of young man who is afraid of reality, who prefers to live in his dreams, and who find less frightening maybe to love somebody that is elsewhere.
Okay, and one other thing I want to mention before Matt and Rebecca ask you some questions is that you mentioned he falls in love with her letters and specifically the poetry that she's writing, and she's writing haikus.
Absolutely.
Slightly weird Japanese poetry.
Short poems, yeah.
So explain why you chose to have haikus in as the thing that Bilodeau falls in love with. Why Japanese?
Well, it was not there at first. In the beginning, my intention was to to make this correspondence between Ségolène and Bilodeau in prose, ordinary prose. But well, it didn't give the effect I was expecting. It was long. It was boring, in fact. And when I fell a little by chance on these haiku books and opened it, I just knew that it was what I needed. These little moments of eternity in 17 syllables were the kind of thing that would fascinate Bilodeau enough to fall in love with a woman that he doesn't know.
Yeah. More mysterious than the prose. If you put in the poetry, that
more magical, yes. Magical in a way.
Okay, we should mention this is certainly the shortest book that we've ever chosen. I mean, would you say this is a novella or is it just a short book? I mean, how would you call it, Denis?
It's a haiku. Mm-hmm.
The book is a haiku.
Yeah, the book itself is a haiku. I like when the form reflects the content. You know, so when I finished the first draft of this book, it was 180 pages. Then I decided to cut because I wanted it to be as short as possible. I wanted it to be some kind of a big haiku, a short novel or a big haiku. So, at a certain point, I stopped to cut because in the end, I would have had only a collection of poems.
Yep.
I wanted it to be a novel. So at 120 pages, I decided that this was it.
And it is The Peculiar Life of a Lonely Postman by Denis Theriault. What did you make of it, Rebecca? You go first.
I thought it was a wonderful book. Small but perfectly formed and beautifully written. I love the concept of this humble postman being transported to another world by the beauty of haikus. I mean, it's not an action-packed book. That's another incredible thing. I mean, that's one of its strengths. It's almost the entire book is what's going on inside Bilodeau's head, you know, which is quite something, quite an achievement. And you write about these things so vividly in such rich detail. And as you said, just now, I love the way the structure of the book, of the story, mimics the circularity theme that goes through the book. And I can very much imagine it as a film or even an animation. I don't know whether that's something you've thought about. I'm sure it is. What I liked most about it was Bilodeau's character. It was very multi-layered, kind of an intriguing mix between him being a very down-to-earth postman, but also this poet and this philosopher with these soaring thoughts. He's quite hard to pigeonhole. And I wondered, how would you describe him?
Bilodeau? For me, Bilodeau is a dreamer, but an active one. Is a poetic warrior who will fight to the end to protect this wonderful dream world that he invented for himself and for the woman that he loves without knowing her, in fact. A poetic warrior. This is how I see him.
You'd be slightly worried if your postman steamed open letters. I mean, it's a bit odd, isn't it? It's a bit dodgy.
It is. Well, it is, but you know, that was one of my fear when I wrote this novel. I was asking myself if I was afraid that Bilodeau would be seen as a psychopath or a dark character, but after all, I decided that it would be some kind of a comedy. I wanted the novel to have a humorous tone, and I think it's finally that kind of character, like Serrano, maybe, or Amélie Poulain,
sure,
which you just can't help to love, even if they do weird things, you know.
You can read a chapter online, go to the Radio 2 website, look for the Drive Time pages and the book club pages. You'll find a chapter of The Peculiar Life of a Lonely Postman there. Matt, what do you think?
I'd say that's actually what drew me into the book, was the idea of this postman who's steaming open the letters. I love that idea. I was certainly intrigued, like Rebecca, by Bilodeau, and I was wondering why, and I reread a bit of it this afternoon, and I said that we never hear him speak at all. It's always sort of just explain a conversation and explain what's going on in that, but we don't actually hear him speak. But this desperation to be a poet is what interested me the most, because he's really enthusiastic, but he's dogged by these feelings of inadequacy, and the first couple of haikus he writes, and I think this is deliberate, aren't very good, but they get much better during the book. And I wondered whether, does this mirror your experience? Did you sort of start with the same enthusiasm when you first embarked on haikus, but doubting whether you were going to be up to it?
Yeah, well, in fact, I had never written a single haiku before writing this novel.
Mm-hmm.
So one could say that I reproduced the behavior of my hero Bilodeau. Like him, for weeks I wrote nothing but haikus. Haiku, days after days, hundreds of haikus. just trying to get good at it, you know. And then I realized that I had to face a second challenge, because for my story to function well, the reader had to feel a progression in his apprenticeship of the art of haiku. In other words, after having learned how to write good haikus, I had to learn how to write bad ones. Mm.
Radio 2 Book Club with a book which was first published in 2005 and is now taking a whole number of different countries by storm. How many, Denis, how many countries are you published in
I
now?
I think by the end of 2015 we'll be published in maybe 15 or 18 countries, something like that. Wow.
So our author is Denis Theriault. The book is The Peculiar Life of a Lonely Postman. I'll get to some listeners' comments in just a moment. A listener's also asked that we haven't actually said who the lady in Guadeloupe is writing to. So this exchange, which our postman is intercepting, who's the other half?
The other half, the legitimate recipient of yes. this letter is called Gaston Grandprix. He's a poet. He's a master poet who lives in Montreal. And he is the one we exchange these haikus with Ségolène's. But when he dies in an accident, Bilodeau makes an extraordinary decision. He decides to impersonate him in order to continue the correspondence with Ségolène, this faraway woman that he doesn't know.
So here comes some listener comments. What happens when people sign up for our book club is they don't know what they're going to get. And if they're drawn out the hat in a kind of computer style, they get chosen. And these are the people who got sent The Peculiar Life of a Lonely Postman. Richard Gregory in Pontypool, first of all. This is not a book I would have naturally been attracted to, and I would have been the poorer for it. What a thoroughly enjoyable little novel this is. The book has a great storyline, contains enough twists and turns and humour to keep you hooked, yet also devastated by the ending. And as if that wasn't enough, what a great introduction to Japanese poetry. It makes me want to start writing haiku and tanka. I'm looking forward to the sequel. Just remind us what tanka is.
Tanka is another form of Japanese poetry. It's a more elaborate form. Instead of 17 syllables in three verses, what is a haiku, it's five verses. A part of it is the original haiku, but add to this is a distich of two verses of seven syllables. So it makes, if I count well, 33 syllables.
Okay. Yeah. Michelle Stell in Clitheroe. I love the way that Denis captured so many lives through their letters, and I thought the idea of emotions burning away almost invisibly behind a screen of innocuous words demonstrated how painfully difficult it can be to express how you feel. I enjoyed the pace of the book and would have read it in one sitting if we weren't going to a steampunk fair. I did think that things fell too conveniently into place when Bilodeau was trying to develop his poetry and writing skills with that one minor quibble. I will be recommending it to my regular book group. Thanks for an enjoyable read, Denis, and to the book club for introducing me to a new author. Wendy George in Arundel in West Sussex. This is a beautifully written and intricately woven story incorporating poetry in the form of Japanese haiku. The story moves along quickly and the ending, with its surprising and extremely clever twist, caught me completely unawares. I'd recommend this as a very good read for anyone who likes a good mystery and a little culture thrown in, ideal for a book club. Jed Barker in Oxford. This charming and gentle novel is magical realism writ small. The novel is skillfully and satisfyingly concluded with a twist that leaves the reader thinking they should have spotted it coming. Enough clues are provided to make it clear that this is a painstakingly fashioned, diligently imagined, polished and accomplished novel. It knows what it wants to achieve and undeniably does so. I would recommend this to a thoughtful reader, but like the haiku at its heart, it feels constructed rather than discovered and so feels more skillfully built than lovingly birthed. Nicely written, Jed. And finally, Diana Buckbury in Market Raisin. I think she's done a haiku, actually, for the review.
Okay.
Moving and simple, but meaning so much. Going to find some haiku poetry books to read. I don't know whether that works or not. A love story with a difference. The things you would do for the one you love. Tragic in places, but uplifting in others. A beautifully written and thought-provoking book. Would recommend this to family and friends looking forward to reading Tanya's story. Now, Tanya's story, just which Diana mentions at the end, just tell us where she fits into this world you've created. Because we haven't mentioned Tanya.
Yeah. Tanya is a young waitress. She works in the restaurant where Bilodeau usually lunch. And she is in love with him, but he doesn't see it Or does he see it and does he prefer not to notice it? You know, Bilodeau is a little strange. Is he hypersensitive or just plain stupid? You can ask the question yourself sometimes.
No, this is I think this is a little bit like a Shakespeare story. So
maybe, yeah.
So she's in love with him, but she's not telling him, and he is in love with her, and he's pretending to be someone else because he's just died, and so they're writing. Anyway, it's fantastic, and we love it very much, Denis. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. And, you know, if you publish a book, your next book, let's say it comes out in 2015, yep. we'll see you in 20 years, you know, by the time everyone else is... what comes next?
Well, next autumn, yes. My publisher, Nicky Griffiths from Hesperus Press, just confirmed me that we will have my first novel, which was entitled The Iguana, but will now has a new title, The Boy Who Belonged to the Sea. And I'm actually in the process of ending the manuscript of a new novel, which is highly connected to The Postman. Uh-huh. It's going to be not a sequel, but a parallel story. The point of view of Tanya, young waitress.
Absolutely, that's what we want. Denis Terrio, we appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much indeed, sir.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, now, check this out. We have next for you only the most honoured female country performer of all time. Check out these statistics. 100 million records sold. 25 gold, platinum and multi-platinum awards. 7 Grammy Awards. 10 Country Music Association Awards. How am I doing so far, Dolly?
Well, my goodness, are you talking about me? When did I have time to do all that?
Hang on, I haven't finished yet. 5 Academy of Country Music Awards, 3 American Music Awards, and is one of only 5 female artists to win the Country Music Association's Entertainer of the Year. Hello, Dolly Parton.
Well, hello. How blessed am I? I tell you, I've been at this a long time, so I've had plenty of years to kind of rack up a few things, and I really am grateful and appreciate every single one of them. Thanks to folks like you and your listeners out there.
Well, I have to say, with all those achievements, it would be very easy for you to think, you know, I've written 3,000 songs. I've had all this. I'm just going to rest and I'm going to take it easy. And yet we find you now with your 42nd studio album, and it's one of the most successful you've ever done.
Well, it's true. I'm so happy about that, even after all these years, that I'm still able to do something that the fans love. And I'm really excited that the Blue Smoke Best Of album has done so well there.
Yeah, so and we've played Home, and we played Try, and we played Lay Your Hands on Me, and we're playing Blue Smoke. And this feels, from this end of everything, Dolly, to be maybe some of the best work you've ever done.
Well, thank you. I'm really proud. You always, you know, everyone I do, I think it's probably the best thing I've done so far. You always try to, you know, to do better every time. But this one has a lot of special songs in it, and I'm just proud that it's been accepted so well. I think in this album it kind of covers almost everything I've done in my career. It has some of the bluegrass things, the country things, a bit of a folk, some of the pop and rocky things. So I think it's really a record of many colors, if you'll pardon the expression.
Yeah, and I think my favorite bits are the bits where the Smoky Mountain DNA is most in evidence, Dolly.
Well, that's very true. I'm always talking about my Smoky Mountain DNA, and I'm like you. I think that's where I'm my best in singing those songs. I love songs like Banks of the Ohio, which is an old song from over in your neck of the woods, you know, a couple hundred years old. But yeah. I love all those great old songs that I grew up singing, and I think my voice is so suited to that folk and mountain stuff, which I love singing that. But I enjoy getting to do all of it. I've been lucky that I've been able to do so many things.
How has your voice changed over the years, Dolly?
Well, I think it's stronger now, and because it's like anything else, if you use it enough, you strengthen the muscles and all. But I still, on those little fragile songs, like those mountain songs, my voice is still kind of, it wants to go back to that original sound with the tremolo and the emotion in it. But I can sing stronger than I used to, you know, in the early days, because I didn't used to sing, for instance, the song Lay Your Hands on Me that we did a cover on and made it into a gospel tune that's in the album. That one, you know, you kind of can sing with more force. But I guess I've just, you know, you just get kind of trained through the years to sing whatever you're singing and to let it be whatever it is. Every song is like it's got its own personality.
Until I heard your version of it, I'd never thought of Lay Your Hands on Me as a gospel song. I thought of it as a sexy song, you know. But
yeah, you're a pervert probably, and I'm a gospel-minded girl. I'm a perverted gospel kind of girl, too. But actually, when I first heard the song being brought up in the Pentecostal church, my grandpa was a preacher, and I grew up where people used to actually, lay hands on people if they were sick or not feeling well. And it was just one of those things, you just lay your hands on somebody and just pray for them, you know, for God to bless them and, you know, to heal them and whatever. And so when I first heard the song, I wasn't listening to the verses.
Uh-huh.
I just heard, you know, like, lay your hands on me, lay your hands on me, lay your hands on me. And I just thought, sure, it was a gospel song because it had all those beautiful voices, too. And so before I actually realized it, I thought, wow, what a great gospel tune. And then I realized it was a sexy love song. But then I kept thinking, well, this could be made into a good gospel tune. And that's exactly what we did and put it in the record. And it's one of my favorites.
So you do accept it as a sexy love song in origin? And it's not just me.
Yes, I do know that. I did learn that right away. But I still thought the melody and just that concept was great for a gospel song.
So you were touring the UK, and the Blue Smoke tour has been going for a while. How was it when you came back to the UK and did Glastonbury? What an extraordinary year you've had.
Boy, I know. That's just been, that whole tour was the highlight of the whole year. We actually had a great tour in Australia and New Zealand in the early part of the year, in February and March, and then we came to Europe for 6 weeks, and boy, it was just amazing, all of it. And then Glastonbury was kind of like the highlight, I think, because I'd never played that before, and I've been asked through the years to do it, and I just felt like it probably wasn't my kind of crowd. I just thought it was probably more of a rock and roll, you know, crowd. But mm-hmm. they really were receptive, and the crowd was great, and I was very humbled by that. And it was a great and fun show to do.
And listening to people who watched that and who were there, Dolly, I came across this quote from the legendary and now sadly late film critic Roger Ebert, who met you, and he said, As he came out, he said he felt as if he'd been mesmerized by a benevolent power. He said, I left the room in a cloud of good feeling. And that could be someone from Glastonbury, someone who saw you on the tour. That's what people think when they've come to one of your shows.
Well, that's good, because I love people, and I hope if I shine and radiate, I like to, you know, think that that's with God's light, because I really am thankful, you know, to God that I've been able to get out and do this, and whatever good things I have, I kind of give it to a higher power. But I just love people, and hopefully that love light shows and they enjoy it. I relate to them. I think a lot of people relate to me, because I grew up in a big family, you know, with humble beginnings, and I think most people can relate to that, but they know how much I love what I do, and I think they can feel that I really do care about them.
Now, if we were all coming to your place for Christmas, Dolly, what would it be like? What would be Christmas at the Partons like? What would it be like?
Oh, well, we're big on decorations. I have two or three houses scattered around different places, and they're all so overdone, like me. I've got so many Christmas lights and so many fun things, and I have a lot of nieces and nephews, and I always dress for the occasion in my little Santa suit and my little Santa dresses and Santa earrings, and then we have the best food in the world. All of my family, we all cook, and all the friends. I spend some part of Christmas with my husband's family, and then part Christmas with my family and friends. So lots of good food, lots of good singing, lots of goodwill.
And your goddaughter Miley Cyrus, will she make an appearance? Have you got her anything for Christmas?
Well, no, I always send her something for Christmas, whether it's just a card or something funny or some little sweet gift if I get to see her during the season. But we usually don't spend Christmas together, because she has her family, we have ours. But it's kind of just our love and relationship with each other is a gift that goes year-round.
We're going to play Blue Smoke just because everybody loves it, and we've been playing it a lot here at Radio 2. What do we need to know about this song that we don't know already, Dolly?
Well, you just need to know that it's a very singable song. It makes you feel good to sing along, even though it's kind of about a leaving song and a busted-up romance. It's kind of got its positive, it's like, I'm going to start over and I'm going to be okay. I got to get out of here. And just sing along with me, because the chorus is really fun and easy to sing and easy to remember.
Dolly, we appreciate time in your presence. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you, and happy holidays.
Thank you, Dolly.
Okay, and Happy New Year, too.
Miranda is here, as you can tell. Old CB user, and we can't really talk about the hell. But how long did you do it for?
It was at university. How sort of naff does that sound? We got sort of, I think, a £300 Ford Fiesta was bombing around university.
Is this Bristol Poly?
Yeah, Bristol Polytechnic. Terrible cough. And, and there's about four or five of us who had clap-tack cars, and then we thought, why not get CB radio? So why?
Then you could just talk to people, and then you meet up, and you could be a gang.
Yeah, we could be a gang, a really embarrassing gang. I don't know why we didn't just go to the pub instead of driving around communicating over radio.
Anyway, that's what everyone else is doing. Hey, you've had a pretty good year, you have to say.
It's been quite a surreal year this year, yeah.
Because?
Because I went on tour. So I think maybe the last time I came in here was probably a year ago, saying that I was going to go on tour, and that's all happened, which is surreal. So I did that.
Done a movie.
And then I've just finished the my sitcom, which will be on air at Christmas. So, yeah, it's been quite a year.
And, OK, well, we'll talk about all the different bits, the different constituent bits of your year.
But thank you for using the word constituent.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
But this tour, I mean, it wasn't any half measures. There were no half measures on this tour. You were going to, like, I know, let's, what could we challenge ourselves? I know, let's go to the very biggest venues that we could possibly find.
No.
Fill them and then try and, I mean.
Try and fill them, yeah. Yes. Yeah, it is weird. Well, because stand-up is, at the moment, is popular enough for comedians to be able to do arenas. And you think, well, why not give it a go? You know, I'm sure I'd regret having not tried it. So I just sort of took a deep breath and did it, but it was pretty full on.
Yes, do you not feel like doing this like medium-sized venues?
I mean, we started doing medium.
Well, the DVD is the O2. I mean,
DVD's O2, yeah.
Which is just, because then there are the various wide shots, you know, yeah. And many people have been there. They know quite how. I mean, it's not possible to, I mean, apart from doing Wembley Stadium, that's the most extraordinary gig to do.
Yeah. It is. It's the ultimate sort of stand-up gig, isn't it? And a lot of people say it's not the right place for stand-up, but actually we live in a television culture, and I suppose you've got television obsessives coming to see the show who are happy to watch it on a screen and get the sort of combined experience. And so you sort of are doing stand-up, but you're also doing a telly show at the same time. It's weird.
You've got a very interesting audience, because I was looking very closely at the... Because presumably we could see more on the DVD than you can. Actually, when you're on stage, you probably only see a couple of rows. But on the behind-the-scenes thing, there's various sort of chats with the audience, and there's a lot of kind of mothers and daughters coming along.
Yeah.
Is that a thing, or was that just at the O2?
Yeah, no, that's... I was surprised that a lot of younger people from sort of 7 till kind of 20 loved the sitcom character and therefore have come along to the show. So there are a lot of teenagers and young people who really warmed to that character, which is lovely.
I suppose there aren't that many stand-up shows, big stand-up shows, that you can take your daughter to.
Yeah, probably. In our age group, it was sort of 12 and up, and then we had some sort of 9-year-olds occasionally snuck in on the front row, which was really cute. So I had to do a very sort of mainstream family show, but I enjoyed that, and I did some matinees and played around with that. But yeah, it was lovely that I think there were some grannies, mothers and daughters who came along, so it's lovely that my humours happened to appeal to family audiences.
The tone is set very early on, where we're still looking at the wide shot, and the audience is sort of dripping in ones and twos, and S Club 7 comes on over the PA.
But I hope you're not disparaging
No, people will know I am a bit of an S Club fan, and yeah. I'm all in favour of the S Club reunion.
Yeah, me too. It's great pop. Reach for the Stars is a great pop tune, is it not?
And it was clearly exactly the right song to play for the demographic that it covered, because they're going absolutely crazy.
Yeah, they loved it. Well, I think it's a song you don't hear very much, and you go, oh, fond memories. And also we got it was a good way to gauge an audience. We'd say, you know, show us your dance moves, and then we'd put the cameras on them and they'd see themselves. And so you'd get a sense of what the audience was like before I came on, which was quite nice. I'd always watch the screens to see. I think, oh no, they're not dancing. I'm going to have to work really hard.
Is it difficult to sort of stay in control, even with an audience? You know, they want to. They're there for a good night. Is it difficult to sort of command an arena?
I think because it's sort of half telly, half live, probably not. Because you can always go to, I had a close-up camera, which I know that I could twist you like I do in my show, and go, shush now, please. But no, funnily enough, there were a couple of heckles or bantering, not bad heckles, but bantering with the audience. And you can sort of include that weirdly in the show. I sort of set it up that it was a party and we were all in this together. And so there were some shouts right from the back, and it was, yeah, it was all right. I managed it. You just don't think about it. You think this is just 500 people. It's not 15,000, it's 500. And then you're fine. You just have to be in denial.
The DVD is called
My What I Call Live Show.
Now, Simon, this is Emma and Shipley. My 12-year-old son, George, thinks Miranda is hilarious, as do I. Please don't stop doing the sitcom.
Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you very much. Well, very sadly, and I have to say, I do feel like something's missing in my life already. On Sunday night, we did film the last ever Miranda in the studio. There wasn't a dry eye, I have to say,
really?
In our last scene.
How does it finish, sort of roughly, vaguely?
Well, as if I'm going to tell you that. That sounded quite cross, isn't it?
As if I'm going to tell you that.
If I'm going to tell anyone, I'll tell
you. Is it obviously
the...
I mean, does it end or does it... You know, could it come back or are you all kind of beamed up to Mars or something?
We are beamed... Oh, spoiler. We're beamed to Mars. No, it is... I do a finale. There's a real finale moment, yeah. Yeah, which I'm always...
Is there a musical number?
Slightly regretting. Well, I always do slight musical numbers.
Do you end... Does it end happily? Are you romantically involved? Do you get married? Have kids?
It's very clever questioning. In Call the Midwife, I'm married.
Yes. No,
I know. I'm trying to avoid the question. Do you see?
I noticed.
It ends. I hope people will understand what I've done with the character and how I've ended it.
What have you done?
Well, I'm not going to tell you.
Roughly, what sort of
thing? You keep going with your very clever journalistic skills. But
I'm just saying the same thing over and over again.
I'm just coming back at you.
A message from Miranda. What have you done today to make you feel proud?
Oh,
I've passed my times table test with 100% and texted you. That's what I've done. I think you're the best. Love, Poppy Allen, aged 8 in Northamptonshire.
She texted me, or do you think she tweeted me?
I think she's texted...
texted via... Right.
Yes.
I was going to get my phone out and see if she's texted
me. She's passed her times table test.
That's brilliant. Well, I passed my 7 times table today, and that's the hardest.
Is it?
Yeah.
Officially?
Well, I found it harder.
7 sixes.
A 42.
9 sevens.
It's quite hard. 63! Isn't it?
I'm asking
Please
the question.
I know what ten sevens.
Very good. 11 sevens, etc. Yeah. Message from Miranda. Okay, there's lots of people. What have you done today to make you feel proud?
Well, I've done my 7 times table. And what else have I done today? I wrote a little comedy sketch for something, for Comic Relief, which you'll see next year.
Who's that with?
That is with some people.
Really? How intriguing.
I don't know whether Comic Relief would be cross with me for saying. I'm being such a tease, aren't I?
No, well, we're just adding to the Comic Relief expectation and levels of interest.
Yes.
By you telling me more about it.
Yeah. No. I'm going to do a sketch.
I saw Miranda at the O2 Arena in Leeds and she was amazing, says Becky.
Oh, thank you.
I've seen Miranda in a school science video, Luke in Kent. He doesn't say whether you're amazing or not.
Well, probably he just missed that off and he meant to say that. I made liquid nitrogen, ice cream out of liquid nitrogen.
We've all done that.
Oh, okay.
Deb's in Brighton. Please, please, could you ask Miranda to say happy birthday to my lovely friend Amanda Strominger's at about 6:10?
Okay. Well, it's 6:25, but happy birthday, Amanda Strominger's?
Strominger's.
Strominger's.
It's the kind of word that looks as though it should have an umlaut over the O.
Okay.
And then it would be Strominger's.
I think it's too early for the word umlaut, isn't it? I think you should only use that after 7.
Okay, I'm very sorry. I saw this story in the paper yesterday and I thought of you.
Oh, okay.
People in their 50s are ditching the Botox, hair dye and cynical worldview, according to a new survey. And it reveals that they feel better than ever and do not care what other people think. And I was reading this and kind of watching your video at the same time, VHS, which I've got.
VHS.
And I don't know, that seemed like first of all, some of the messages that you're trying to get out and a lot of the audience who come to you look exactly like, these are people who are thinking, you know what, I don't care what anyone thinks, I'm just having a great time.
Yeah, and also Botox is incredibly bad for me. Why am I doing this? And also, why am I doing this? Because I look 55 just with Botox. It just doesn't work.
But you've got a whole sequence about how old people are actually happier. Now.
I think, yeah, well, I don't know about you. I mean, you're very old, so yes, I can ask you this.
Yeah, thanks very much. Moving on now with Paul McCartney on Radio 2.
But don't you get happier as you get older?
I think so.
Because you get more confident
in
yourself.
Bob Geldof theory is that when you get into your 50s, you're kind of at ease with yourself.
Yes.
And you know, I'm not saying you're in your 50s, obviously, because you're not. But, you know who you are, you know who your friends are. And
exactly that. All you miss is not sort of leaping out of bed every morning with the energy of your 20-year-old body, apart from that, it's much better. So, yeah, I've just... And also, I suppose the Miranda character in the sitcom as well was very much trying to be herself, which is what teenagers are constantly trying to be. So I'm trying to tell young people, just let go of it as soon as you can.
The Midwife Christmas special.
Yes.
Tell us what... Oh, no, you're not going to... You're just not going to tell us anything.
No, I can tell you about Little Chum Chum, as I call her.
Go on.
Chummy, my character. She... She's dealing with the battle of having a vocation and also having a child and a husband at home. And in 1959, I mean, it's difficult now, but in 1959, obviously, that was an issue. And she finds something she really wants to do, which is go and run a mother and baby home for young adults who've got pregnant by mistake and have to give away their child. So it's a very emotional and sort of tough storyline. But Heidi Thomas, the writer, has done it beautifully. So that's what Chummy goes off to
do. And that's not finishing.
That's not finishing, no. No, they've already commissioned a series 5, it would be now.
And how are you going to replace the sitcom? What, with other stuff?
I don't
more
know
global
yet.
Domination?
I think I need to do a bit of sort of lying down and stepping back from it all, because it's been a bit of a whirlwind, of which I'm very grateful. But you sort of don't have the time to think. So I need to step back and think what next, really?
Because you've got a movie coming up with like a spy movie? Is
yes.
That with Jude Law?
It's a comedy called Spy. So it's a sort of James Bond, but funny, with Melissa McCarthy as the lead and Jude Law was in it. Yes, I've got to act with Jude Law, which is very exciting. So, yeah.
So is that the kind of thing that you would like to do?
I'd love to do more acting and step away a little bit from the writing the comedy, which is a high-pressured job, and just have a bit of time away and then find the joy again for comedy.
And then maybe you could incorporate, because you did a politics degree at Bristol Poly, which it has been pointed out many times is now the University of West England. But
yes, it changed to that when I arrived, and that is no joke. They saw me coming and thought, we must immediately switch this to a university. Look at the calibre of people that are now entering this building.
So, Miranda, we appreciate you coming in. Any more tours? Any more kind of live events? Or have you frankly had it with that?
I might tour again. Who knows? I don't know what will happen with the sitcom characters. I should say there's a book of the sitcom scripts out.
Oh, my goodness me.
Well, just
how much product do you want to sell
but
me?
They were very kindly saying they were missing the sitcom, but you can reenact it.
Oh, that's very nice. Okay.
In your sitting rooms.
Is there a T-shirt? Is there a hat?
There is, actually.
Antlers. What's Christmas like in the Miranda Hart house? What's a Hart
Christmas?
Oh,
it's fun times. It's blow-up Santas and silliness. It's onesies.
And are you actually fed up with anyone shouting such fun at you?
Never.
As you walk down the street?
Never. I'm so beyond thrilled that my sitcom was watched by more than 10 people and has been loved. I just will never... I'll be eternally grateful and happy
about
that. And
what happens
that.
In the last show? You were just about to...
I was just about to say that we... Cut to song.
I'll do that then. Thanks, Miranda. Well, it's a Foodie Thursday, and the food is smelling terrific. The studio's terrific. Joe Wiley, have you got some left for Joe Wiley and her team?
Oh, yes, I know too well that, okay. To make sure I feed them. Yes.
Spiced roast lamb with pumpkin and sultanas. It's actually got a special name.
Yes, it has roun-e-bare, as it's a Persian recipe, now modern-day Iran, from chef Greg Malouf, born in Australia to Lebanese parents. He was exec chef at Momo in Melbourne and is currently behind the stoves at Clay in Dubai. His magnificent coffee table book, Saraban, named after the head of a camel train, which would lead travellers across the desert, a bit like a modern-day tour guide. And it's co-written, beautifully photographed by his ex-wife, Lucy Malouf. They're obviously getting on well, because they've written, I think, 7 books together, so that's all good news. Well done, them. I tracked down the leg of lamb...
I thought you said ex-wife.
Yes. Yeah, I did. But we still work together.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So they've worked it out.
Yeah, which is very good and grown up and well done them.
Don't feel you need to editorialise anymore, by the way.
No, you're right. No, move on.
Stick to
quite
the food.
Right. Okay, the lamb, it's a Texel lamb born in April, so now coming into its own very much over winter. That's when lamb really is best. I tracked it down via the Big Barn website set up by Anthony Davison, fifth generation Bedfordshire based arable farmer, so growing crops, who was fed up being dictated to by the large retailers, so established Big Barn as a way for the public to buy direct from the artisan food producers. There are now 6,500 on the site. And we spend £120 billion annually at supermarkets, so it's a good way of spreading some of the financial love by supporting farmers and local shops. And, we can actually save a bit of money in the process, which appeals to me. And via the Big Barn, I discovered Jimmy Bell, a.k.a. the Lamb Man, whose family have been farming for 400 years in Northumberland. And he's based near Morpeth at East Wingate's farm, where he farms with his Mrs. Kirsty. The lamb here has been hung for 10 days. It travelled only just under 20 miles to the abattoir, so not too far. That's, it makes it far less stressful for the animals, which is always important. And you can taste that as well, so they haven't got, they're not full of adrenaline. And was butchered by Jimmy himself. And the recipe uses a really lovely Persian spice mix of dried cardamom, caraway, nutmeg, cinnamon, salt and pepper, with fresh garlic and chilli bound together with olive oil. And I liberally smeared that over the leg of a lamb. Pumpkin and sultanas feature. They bring out the underlying sweetness of the meat and other ingredients.
Can I just say, before you do the other ingredients, can you address those who've said that? And there, some of the some of these views are represented by the production team, but also the occasional listener has said, what are you doing putting sultanas in?
Yeah, well, it is.
It's not a problem for me because I like them.
No, fun if Sarah Cox this morning was, you know.
I know she did, didn't she?
Yeah, she would. Fruit with meat, that's not right. And then she went off, as I occasionally do, on with these the curries that we grew up with, which would have almost a whole tin of peaches in it, but tin peaches, as I say, desiccated or denigrated coconut, as we very amusingly called it, we three boys. And that had sultanas in it. I don't think it bore much resemblance to a curry that you would have anywhere in India. But it, in this case, it does work. It's very far east, and also, I mean, in North Africa and in Sicily, for instance, you get a lot of fruit with meat. So let's find out the fruit. You know, the proof will be.
Okay, so
in
those other ingredients then:
onions, shallots, rice, yogurt, and verd juice, which is fermented grape juice, which is widely available, much used in Australia, but now you can get it here. But rather than buying it specially, you can substitute white wine vinegar, lemon juice, or a touch of dry sherry.
Okay, it's Foodie Thursday spice roast lamb with pumpkin and sultana. I've just tweeted a picture. We'll put some stuff on our Facebook page. And if you have enough time, you can go to the website and you look for the episode pages, and all the details are going to be there. So you've given us all the ingredients, Nigel. What do we actually do with them all?
Yeah, I love this. Great ingredients, but it's a lovely assemblage from Australia, Lebanon, Persia, Northumberland. Kicked off by making the spice paste by pounding together with a pestle and mortar garlic, shallots, chilli, salt, caraway seeds, cardamom, cinnamon, nutmeg and black pepper, and then stirred in 50 millilitres of olive oil. Got my hands nice and mucky by rubbing the paste all over the lamb prior to 40 minutes in a 200 degree oven, which I reduced to 180°C after 20 minutes. After that, I went another 40 mil of olive oil and the chunks of pumpkin, quartered onions and sultanas for a good coating in the spicy oil. And finally, the lamb and veg were returned from the pan to the oven and for a further 20 minutes cooking. So basically, it was an hour's cooking in total. And the meat needs to rest for at least 15 minutes before carving to ensure that it's beautifully moist and the juices don't escape onto the plate. The vegetables can be kept warm in the oven at the same time, and I've served it all up with the pan juices and lots of rice and yoghurt. So actually pretty straightforward.
We didn't have time. We didn't have time for the gravy or the yoghurt.
The yoghurt should be dolloped. Oh, there, dollops coming now of the.
Okay, so the yoghurt is. That's. I have to say, so far, without the gravy or the yoghurt, this might be one of my favourite dishes of the year.
Great. Gosh.
So the key, what's the key ingredient? What is the thing that makes this special? What is it that you've put in here that's making it particularly?
Well, apart from it being outstanding lamb man lamb, it's Texel, but it is the spice mix is just stunning. And
that's the key, isn't it?
Yeah. And when I was making it, I had a lot of fun as well with a pestle and mortar. It's one of those, if you haven't got a pestle and mortar, do get one for Christmas. Put it on your list because it's something, it makes cooking really fun. And also, there's no doubt when you do start pounding up things like garlic, shallots, and then put in cinnamon, caraway seeds, and black pepper and all the different spices that I used, it really, the smell is just gorgeous. So you know, once you coat it in that, then it's got to come up with this beautiful, lovely flavour. And of course, it then seeps in because you've got oil in there over the veg, which I've cooked around it. So it's really straightforward, but just great taste. But just very un-British, but although most of the ingredients are British.
Spice roast lamb with pumpkin and sultanas. And, OK, so getting that spice mix is the absolute key because this tastes terrific. What do you think, Rebecca?
I'm with you, Simon. I totally... Oh, that is...
You've still got your mouth
delicious.
Woo-hoo!
Sorry. Really, really, really good. And the lamb goes very well with the sweetness of the pumpkin, the slight spiciness. Lovely winter food. Just great. It's quite Moroccan, isn't it, in a way, with the yogurt.
Doing this
but,
now.
Yeah. Mm.
We'll just carry on doing this for the rest of the evening.
Yes. Oh, good. Yeah, that's fine. Suits me. Beats my parents' evening. Well, I've got plans.
Matt, what do you make of spice roast lamb with pumpkin and sultanas?
This is fantastic, Nige. I'm loving this. I heard you saying about... Because whenever you do a meat dish like this, that your meat always is so succulent and juicy. So, and I heard you giving a sort of tip about you have to let it stand for a little while. Mine never tastes as good or is never as succulent as yours. So just tell me again.
Basically, the key to all these meat is not to cut into them too quickly. Because what happens is all the juices then run out across the plate. If you leave them to rest 15-20 minutes, then the meat relaxes and all the moisture, particularly if you cook it on the bone, which is this stuff, this is cooked on the bone, and all the moistures go back into the fibres of meat. So basically the moisture retains in it. And you know, last week when we did it we cooked the pheasant in the hay, again, that was great because it can dry out, but by covering it in hay, which we doused in cider, or you could use apple juice, then again, it's a great way of keeping the meat moist. And that's the key with cooking meat, is to make sure it doesn't dry out. And in fact, on... the Thursday before Christmas, we're going to be doing Tuesday, Wednesday edible gifts. And then on the Thursday, we're going to give 10 top tips to make sure that your Christmas day is as least stressful as possible, but as tasty before we do
so
it.
So how long? About 10 minutes, I should like?
15, 20. Okay. And your turkey, you can do it up to an hour if it's decent, so don't worry about it.
So lots of festive stuff coming up. That's the week after next. So next week, there's no Nige, which is very, really, really bad. It's going to alter our eating arrangements because it's the BBC Music Awards.
Oh, right.
No, let's
no,
try
that's
that.
Great.
Let's
great
try
news.
That again.
Yes.
Next week is the BBC Music
Ooh,
Awards.
Oh, that's fabulous!
There you go. That's
Can't
what
wait.
It is. That's what it is.
No, he was upset
happening.
Because you weren't going to get any food.
That's exactly why.
Buy your own. Buy your own. Instead of sponging off the show.
top tips.
Yeah,
interesting drinks here.
Yes.
The soft drink is it's amazing. It's actually a blend of kiwis and pear juice, and it's called Piwi, P-I-W-I. I think that's a really good... I love that little mixture because the kiwi gives it a bit of fruit, but also there's a slight spice element to it. Okay. And I thought it worked very well with this. And the red, I think it's
the red's belting. Very good.
It's a fantastic. Yeah. It's a Carmen Gran Reserve 2011 from Chile, celebrating 20 years of a Carmenere grapes, which are planted in the Alto Mayapo vineyard in Alpata in the Colchagua Valley in central Chile. And it's believed to originate from the Merlot grape of Bordeaux. But I think it's fantastic wine. And Carmenere is one of those grape varieties. Do look out. It's a good one to be able to mention in dinner parties.
And if you're not sure about the pronunciation, just charge your way through
it. Yeah, just go through it. Just say it loudly and confidently.
Heaven forbid. Top tips.
Yes.
Check and turn the veg from time to time to ensure they cook evenly and are unctuously browned in the spicy oil. And the lamb's been cooked medium rare, but if you prefer it less pink, put it back in the oven for a little longer.
Excellent. Mm. Might even have a go. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I think
it was really, as I say, fun, but straightforward and easy to do.
Spice roast lamb with pumpkin and sultanas. Details online. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, that was it. Not bad, really, in places. Don't forget to download the Confessions podcast and then we'll do it again next week.